This is from the Shoroku collection of Koan's case 68. Kasan swinging the sword, the pointer. Inside the castle is the emperor's decree. Outside the gate is the general's command. Sometimes power is obtained at the gates. Other times reverence is admired within the chamber. Tell me, who is such a person? The case. Attention. Monk asks Kasan, how about when sweeping out the dust to see the Buddha? Kasan said, straight away slash with a sword. If you don't, the fisherman will live in a nest. Monk then went to ask Sekiso, how about when sweeping out the dust you see the Buddha? Sekiso said, he has no country. Where can he be met? The monk returned to Kasan and related it to him. Kasan ascended the high seat and said, in setting up expedients, I am better than he. But as to the profound talk of the principle, he is 100 paces ahead of me. The verse, the sword spirit drives out the bull. The heavens are washing the soldiers. To achieve the quelling of a riot, who is he? Once there were battle clouds, the four seas were clear. With flowing robes, the emperor's governing is naturally effortless. So Dogen said, don't take it lightly, don't give it weight. And I find that this is such incredible advice. At all times, on the cushion, off the cushion, whatever we do, it is life-giving. Let me close the door, please. It is a life-giving way of being, right? This examination of keeping the finger on the pulse. Am I giving it weight? And the it is wide open. Any it will work for that. Am I giving it weight? Am I taking it lightly? Am I caring too much? Do I not care at all? It's very important to work with. So one true samadhi extinguishes evils. It purifies karma, dissolving obstructions. Then where are the dark paths to lead us astray? We ask. Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where you sit is the pure lotus land. And this very body is the body of Buddha. Right, these incredibly powerful words of Hakuin, just chanted. Simple and true. Yet for most people, these words represent an elusive idea that remains out of reach. Detached from an actual personal experience. In our everyday life, we often encounter all sorts of obstacles. We find ourselves perpetuating harmful karma. We follow dark paths that do lead us astray. We become discouraged, feel unworthy, alienated, or just feel stuck and discontent. This is quite common to feel this way. But we have to ask, is it because we happen to live in very challenging times, which we do? Is it because we're often pulled in many directions and have to cope with stressful environments? Is it because of the impermanent nature of life? Why? Why are we like this most of the time? In other words, we can ask, is it life itself that prevents us from realizing that this very body is the body of Buddha? And what does that even mean? Sometimes the statement is confusing. You're a Buddha. What do I do with that? I definitely don't feel like that. Now, most of us juggle between endless responsibilities. So we play a catch-up game with the clock, trying to keep up with being on time at work, pick up the kids, make dinner, walk the dog, get to the zafu for zazen. And as we run around from one task to another, our hasty footsteps raise a lot of dust that impairs our view, gets in the eyes, makes it difficult to breathe. It also annoyingly gets into every nook and cranny of our lives, and we end up spending lots of time trying to clean it faster than it accumulates. But the reality of it is quite grim. And the more we clean, the more it accumulates and gums up our lives. And this is the case even for those who may not have so many responsibilities. Well, if you ask them, they will say they have a lot, but who doesn't say that, right? And often, even when we go on vacation, we find it impossible to avoid encountering the dust. And so we may turn to Zen practice to solve this persistent issue. The Zen tradition has this pristinely clean image. Highlight that. And many people think that practitioners live a dust-free life. But is it true? Are we engaged here in the work of learning how to beat the clock and clear up the dust faster than it accumulates? Reminds me of an article I read some time ago by a Japanese Zen teacher who was talking about when he first got engaged with the practice. He was talking about his experience with that, and he said he was very excited because he felt that he had discovered the best vacuum cleaner in the world, right? So Zen, right? I'm going to cut through all that and vacuum it much faster than it accumulates. And then he said, only to soon realize that it wasn't quite so. It's not that it doesn't work. It just doesn't work in the way we think it should work. It's not even that we don't work or something's wrong with us. But the belief that there is a way to bypass complications and entanglements gives rise to the notion that it is wrong to experience bumps on the road, disappointments, pain, loss. There's a saying in Zen that addresses this. It says, when a fish swims, the water gets muddied. When a bird flies, it inevitably loses feathers. As long as we are alive, we all create, we're bound to keep creating an experience, dust, in forms of complications, challenges, afflictions. Some of it we cause directly, knowingly, some indirectly. And the fact that throughout our lives the water gets muddied and feathers fall is not up for debate. So that's not a question. But we have to ask, is it an issue? Is it a barrier? Is it a problem? Is it something that needs to be changed or fixed? If we think that the dust is the cause of our discontentment, unhappiness, then yes, it is an issue, and yes, we are destined to never experience any lasting sense of contentment, simply because it will never end, inner and outer dust. And our daily reality by nature will not become clearer or more stable. Somehow, we tend to hold on to the assumption that the changing circumstances, unpleasant sensations, undesirable situations are the causes for our inner discontentment. You can even say that we are indoctrinated by our upbringing and society to be convinced that this is a valid assumption. And that is to our detriment, since it creates a perpetual state of bondage from which there is no way out. So there is that. Yet the Buddha realized and taught extensively that freedom is not only attainable, it is our natural domain as human beings. But he also pointed out that we each can and must realize this truth on our own, or this natural domain will remain unavailable in our lives. And the point is not to swap one assumption for another and get re-indoctrinated as a Buddha, or believe something, or let go of one belief and take on another. It is about being unchained to any form or any dogmatic functioning, including the practice of Zen. And sometimes, maybe more importantly, for Zen practitioners to recognize that it includes that too. Right? So it means to practice free, not under some kind of bondage or creating a bondage from what we practice. So as practitioners, our primary task is to verify this on our own and examine if the dust is indeed the culprit that robs us of experiencing equanimity, contentment, and some sense of inner peace in this mad world, right now, today, with all the fires that are raging all over the world. So, while not running away from the unpleasant thoughts or turning away from the pain and discomfort, right? So, this has to happen. The examination, the recognition has to happen while not turning away from pain and discomfort, while not trying to rearrange our life to fit our personal desires. While all that is going on, we observe the assumption. And we pose the essential question of spiritual journey. Is it the dust of the world that's binding me? So not to assume and point a finger, but to ask, continuously to ask, is it that? It feels like that, but is it? I'm hungry, I'm tired, I'm unhappy about this, I'm pissed off, I'm angry. So that's it. So by saying that to ourselves or others, are we saying that until this is over, until the thing that I am pissed off about is no longer, again, inner and outer, it doesn't matter, am I saying that until then, there's no way I can experience anything else or any other state of being. So to do that, to actually inquire, requires us to raise the level of awareness and illuminate whatever we believe is binding us. Right? We ask the question, not disconnecting. We ask the question in relation to something or someone. So we have to illuminate it and verify if it's so. And awareness, we speak often of awareness. Awareness is like a flashlight. By its nature, like a flashlight, it has the power to show what's happening without getting entangled by what is happening. It's like the beam of a flashlight, never stained by what it illuminates. Gold, crap. The illumination doesn't have any preferences. Somehow it stays pure, clean, as is. Doesn't take it on. Doesn't absorb any of it. So when you experience anger, sadness, fear, loneliness, insecurity, the awareness itself, being aware of that, the awareness itself is not angry, lonely, sad, afraid, or insecure. It only shows the arising emotion, as is, without getting entangled in it. We're not trying to create split personality here. I hope you understand. Right, so but the awareness coexists with everything. It's not me and my other me. But we're not taught to perceive reality in such a way. And we derive comfort and security from our familiar ways of interacting with reality. So it takes courage to willfully, willingly mess with that. Even to ask the question, it takes courage. Right? It takes courage to doubt the assumptions, to examine attachments, to examine, to even say, this may be a delusion. Or I may be holding on to a delusion. Even that takes guts. I may not want to say that. So after all, these are the fundamental building blocks that comprise of the ego itself. So what needs to be removed to actually see the Buddha that you are? What are we removing out of what? In this koan, a monk went to see two different teachers and posed this question. How about when sweeping out the dust, seeing the Buddha? Sweeping out the dust to see the Buddha. In the context of Zen training, to see the Buddha means to see into one's true nature. And the dust refers to our delusions that arise through our daily interactions with life, as I mentioned before. But the phrase sweeping out the dust is problematic since it seems to affirm the notion that life's challenges have the power to form a barrier that separates us from ourselves. So maybe this monk is asking the question because he still holds on to the assumption that life is hindering him and that he wants to find a way out. Maybe he already had found a way out. He had Kensho experience and he wants to be verified. Maybe he's just looking for encouragement in practice. We don't know what's going on in his mind, but then it doesn't matter. For us, the relevant question is most intimate. It always comes down to you and your practice, or you and your life. So what do you feel is holding you back from realizing your true self? We have to look at that word too, realizing. What does that mean? Right? It has real in it. So there is that. What is not real? What is made up? So realizing the true self. What clouds your mind and impairs your vision? What do you give a lot of weight to? Usually is hinting a direction of exploration. And it's not the thing that I give weight to as much as me in relation to that, or what is triggered when this arises, or somebody wants to say something about it or take it away from me. So what impairs the vision? To explore this question further, I want to refer to the six root kleshas and read from the same source I've been using during our discussion on karma, text by Chogyam Trungpa. So kleshas are known as defilements or conflicting emotions. Kleshas are minute at the beginning, but their consequences are large and disastrous, as we see. The origin of conflicting emotions is that you are jumpy and always looking for entertainment. And what he's talking about here, entertainment, is really what we often experience on the cushion, right? So we are sitting and we are paying attention to the breath or to the body or to just being, but it's not entertaining, right? So thoughts are a lot more entertaining. So we go with that, or we look for that, or we regurgitate that. So we're looking for entertainment. Klesha seems magically to manifest out of the blue and come to your attention, but they do so because you are ready for them. Because you're ready for them. Because something in you corresponds with that. Something in your state of being corresponds with that at that moment. Having already created an object and directed your attention to it, you develop further confusion in which desirable things are seen as undesirable and undesirable things are seen as desirable. Being upside down, as the Buddha said. That little perversion takes place. The process is slightly twisted. You do not know who you are or what your actual desires are. There are all kinds of possibilities, but with all of them, there is a slight twist, which could be described as mistaken perception. Out of this basic mental setup, passion, aggression, ignorance, and all kinds of subsidiary emotions begin to arise. Traditional texts describe the nature of emotions as disturbances and chaos. Conflicting emotions are the ups and downs and irregularities that take place in your mind. So what he's saying here is that it starts with a minute shift, which we talked about in our discussions about karma, minute shift of attention, right? So there is something that shows up and it becomes a focal point of attention. And then if we're not aware, we're not doing anything different, we're going to do the same thing again and again. If we're not aware, then it starts to spark something and that builds up. So it's a minute shift. And he says it feels as if it came out of the blue, but it didn't, because something in me kind of went along with that, corresponded with that, and then went along with that. And he said, I continue reading, he said, There are six root emotions, six root kleshas: desire, anger, pride, ignorance, doubt, and opinion. Again, desire, anger, pride, ignorance, doubt, and opinion. You can adjust your position if needed. Those six kleshas are known as that which disturbs tranquility. So generally, we have a hard time finding any little space in which to have the experience of tranquility or peace. Tranquility is simply a temporary relief from indulging in one of those six states of being. The six root kleshas arise in succession out of basic stupidity or bewilderment. That is, from the bewilderment of not knowing what to do comes the sudden flickering of thoughts. That begins to make you very passionate and lustful. So the first klesha is desire. Actually, it is more like lust than desire. You become horny about yourself and your state of bewilderment. Fall in love with that. Of course, we don't want to admit that, but we have to look. Then, since you are unable to experience the proper fulfillment of that horniness, you experience anger, because it goes nowhere. It goes around in circles, and we get upset. Out of that anger and inability to fulfill yourself comes pride or arrogance as kind of self-preservation or self-maintenance. After that comes carelessness, uncertainty, or ignorance. This ignorance is a different sort of ignorance from the initial triggering process. It is not basic bewilderment, but rather simply boycotting situations, ignoring things, refusing to see things in an intelligent way. In a way, you're refusing to be practical. And I think often practicality or being pragmatic about life offers us a way out. Well, sometimes it becomes another way in, right? Because we go from one to another, and now we're all about being practical. And then we may reject those who are not practical. That's not what this is talking about. So passion leads to aggression, which leads to pride, which leads to a stupefied sort of non-caring. And those are the first four kleshas. Ignoring then develops into the fifth klesha, which is known as doubt. You do not trust any possible alternative, and you do not want advice or any way out. You doubt the teachings, the teacher, and the Buddha Dharma. You even doubt the simple, sensible norms of everyday existence. I think it's from what he's talking about. It's actually very familiar. We get so caught up in our state of neurosis that we do fall in love with it, and we actually don't want, we say we want out. But everything we do helps it sustain itself, or helps us stay in that state of being. So there is a discrepancy between what we say we want and the way we speak and act often. Then he says, from that comes the six kleshas, which is known as view or opinion. You form a certain opinion which you use to solidify your trip. You say, this is it. I've got it. I know it. I refuse to believe anything else. This is my view. This is my idea. This is why what I've come to believe is the right thing to do. Or this is who I think I am. Or you all. So this is how it begins and becomes calcified. It becomes rigid, fixed, uptight, unyielding. It's a very painful way to be for oneself, but it's also causing a lot of pain to others. And it begins at that level, but then how far it goes, there's no end to that. In other words, how much harm it will cause, that minute shift, how much harm it will cause, the answer to that is all around. In other words, there's no end to the madness or how far the madness will reach. It just grows and grows and grows exponentially. Which means we become more rigid in reaction to that too. So looking at these six root kleshas, we can easily see the creation of a mental barrier that is formed by the way we interact with reality. And, you know, maybe we should include ourselves too when we say interacting with reality. We're not talking about this interacts with that. We're talking about interacting. We're talking about manifesting. We're talking about being, functioning. Right? So when we talk about triggers, there is no the other thing and then me here being triggered. It all happens at the same time. So without awareness, everything that happens in life can become a trigger for further neurosis and stuckness. And it can create a cocoon that holds us back from experiencing a Buddha, who we are. But when we become aware of the triggers and the process, then everything that happens can be an opportunity for us to become less rigid, to become more open. So whether it's medicine or poison, has a lot to do with us. Because what is poison can lead to medicine or can become a catalyst for wisdom or a catalyst for further poisoning. And we can experience a greater sense of clarity within the mud of everyday life. But even then, we still need to remain watchful so the sense of clarity and freedom does not become a new source of stagnation. And again, don't take it lightly, don't give it weight. Ah, yeah, there's that. Okay, I see, I feel, I experience. And then we move. If we move, we're not taking it lightly, we're not giving it weight. We just move. We just change. We agree to change. So how about when sweeping out the dust to see the Buddha? The monk asked. And then Kasan responded to him with a clear warning. Straight away, slash with the sword. He's saying, watch out. If you don't, the fishermen will live in the nest. And Zen uses the vivid image of a sword to illustrate the power of wisdom and realization The sword is available to everybody. It's not something we have to go get somewhere. It is at our capacity. But most people walk around in the dark without ever knowing it is within their capacity. And some recognize its presence but are not very skilled in using it. So the familiar phrase from the Diamond Sutra tells us how to use it. It says, dwelling nowhere, raise the body-mind. Or raise the sword. If you think you're held back by life or obstructed by your thoughts and emotions, acknowledge it. Just acknowledge it. But don't dwell there. And do not create the one who is stuck. If you think you were able to cut through the emotional entanglements and experience some measure of liberation from the common traps of our society or from your habitual karmic streams, again, just acknowledge it. Do not dwell there and do not create the one who is free and enlightened. So Zazen is the method to realize our great capacity to cut through. And life, whatever happens in life, is the place to apply this great capacity. And to illustrate how we get stuck, Kazan here is using the example of a fisherman who goes to the reeds to catch a fish, but then gets himself caught up in the reeds and cannot get his boat out of there. Clear image shows our tendency to identify with what we think, what we feel, what we believe. So then the monk went to see Sekiso with the same question. And then Sekiso answered, "He has no country. She has no country. Where can she be met?" Forms, names, addresses, countries, borders, only provisional expressions that may serve a purpose and do serve a purpose, but remain limited to time, space, and conditions. On the other hand, the word Buddha refers to that which is timeless, formless, nameless, limitless. So being in the weeds of everyday life, dealing with the constant dust we raise wherever we go, functioning within the fragility of having a physical body, are we destined to remain a part of Buddhahood? As long as a Buddha remains a conceptual image, then there is a fixed state of a human being who is held back by life, and a fixed idea of a Buddha who is liberated from life's challenges. How can one meet the other? Those are completely two different realms. Yet, Hakuin Song of Zazen ends by saying that this earth where you stand is the pure lotus land. And this very body, achy, painful, aging body is the body of a Buddha. Hakuin is simply expressing the ancient teaching of non-duality, which is found in a lot of Buddhist literature and in our chants. Right? We chant again and again. Form is no other than formlessness. Formlessness no other than form. So the more relevant question is, how can we not meet the Buddha? What do we do to believe or to create the belief that we're not? And we have to go search for that. How do we reject who we truly are? We've become so proficient at nursing delusions And we often don't even see another way of living. This is why he refers to that as the doubt. We doubt. We don't even believe that there is another way to be. But there is. In the commentary to this, Shishin says, if your energy channels are all open, delusive thoughts will pass through. To let them go, we have to illuminate our hidden beliefs. Our hidden beliefs help us maintain our position of arrogance, anger, hatred, laziness, indifference, self-pity. Our hidden beliefs. So when they are not hidden, then what happens to all these states of being? Then he says we attach to all of those things in order to protect that self-grasping ego and maintain it. Just let go of all your opinions and the Buddha appears. But Kassan says, don't hold on to it. Master Sekiso says, where would you meet the Buddha? She has no name, no country, no gender, no occupation, no rank, no soul, no mother, no father, and no lover. She doesn't even have a face. If we say all the dust has been swept, what about the new dust ball you are creating that you call a Buddha? What about the new ideas that are being formed in your mind right now? Oh, if it's not this, it must be that. If I'm not this, I must be that. And then he ends by saying, you can't depend on it. You can't depend on it because you can't, because it crumbles right in front of your eyes. Crumbles. Any idea, any opinion is doomed to be that way. You can adjust if needed. Monk in this koan was still confused even after seeing Sekiso. So he got two answers from two different teachers. He went back to Kassan and told him how Sekiso dealt with the question. Kassan ascended the seat and said, in setting up expedience, I am better than he. But as to a profound talk of the principle, he is 100 paces ahead of me. So Kassan and Sekiso are expressing two different paths to realization. The use of the soul symbolizes a skillful but abrupt way to cut delusions, to cut through delusions, and wake up through a shout, a strike, or a pain that we experience, some kind of pain that we experience. The use of a steady and profound talk is more like a gentle process of slow cooking, which in terms of practice means zazen, lots of zazen, some exposure to a teacher, teisho, reading, continuous slow immersion in the practice. So one unified practice, different skillful methods. And we should probably add that they may be skillful, but the skillfulness of a method has everything to do with the moment in time that it is being used and with the person. It may be skillful, but it may not be timely. It may be skillful, but not for that person right now. If we think it is skillful all the time, then we become rigid. So there's that division. We also need to recognize how we might be dividing our practice to internal and external. So to shed light on this division, the pointer The Quran uses the analogy of the way emperors used to govern at that time. The first two lines says, inside the castle is the emperor's decree. Outside the gate is the general's command. Sometimes power is obtained at the gates, Qasan. And other times reverence is admired within the chamber, Sekiso. Emperors had this undisputed command over people within the walls of a castle or city, but resorted to military control in order to govern people outside the walls or in remote areas. And this is used here as an example of how we divide having control over our inner world and control outside, over outside circumstances and conditions. But in reality, those walls do not exist. And through practice, we can learn. We can learn to create seamless way of practicing. Seamless and nameless, although they are names. But essentially, the practice itself has no time and name and place. So Qasan expressed the skillful use of the sword that has the power to cut through delusion in the middle of our challenging everyday life, where conditions may appear undesirable and almost non-conducive for equanimity. But sometimes power is obtained at the gates. And Sekiso expressed the sublime power of sustained and unwavering determination as it manifests in our practice, steady zazen practice. Both ways are skillful, effective methods that we need to interweave into one continuous practice and sustain it wholeheartedly, especially when we feel discouraged, especially when life seems unbearably challenging and painful. Times we say, I can't take this anymore. Those are times to examine which method will be most skillful right now? And use it. So on that, Shishin commented, Qasan and Sekiso say they each express one piece. Master Bansho commented, where is the person with two faces on one die? How can you bring both pieces together? Because in reality, they are not two separate things. There are numerous paths to enter the way of Zen. There are as many paths as there are practitioners. Even Bodhidharma talked about entering by method or entering by principle. Qasan is talking about entering by method. Sekiso, entering by principle. Either way, drop off your attachment to your own thoughts, ideas, judgments, and opinions. Whether it's by expedience or principle, it doesn't matter. We don't even need to call it anything at all. Wherever you are, enter Zen from there. Wherever you are, always take heed. Become a whole person. Even half a person will suffice for now. Don't let this understanding die out. Don't let this understanding die out. So what they're saying, the Buddha said, talked about, taught, is that we're not in question. Our essence, our natural state of being, true self, it's not in question. But there is a very, very important imperative question we have to keep looking at. What is creating the barrier or the gap? If I go to the feeling and I say, well, here's the feeling, therefore it is true, then that's it. Then I affirm it to myself that there's no other way. Because I feel this way, because I think this way, because I believe. But if we go to reality itself, and reality itself is again the one who is sitting on this cushion, right? You just go directly to and then experience. And there will be a different kind of experience, waiting to be experienced. It's kind of like what we say about the blinds, right? You know, we may be inside the house, the blinds are closed, everything is shut down, shut off. And we say, I hear about the sun, I have no idea how to get there. I wish it'll be here today. It may be sunny, but you don't know that. But it takes an effort or the recognition that there may be something I need to do here. Right? So instead of wallowing in my own misery, which we often do, I can reach out the hand and then turn this thing that opens up the blind. Right? A little bit of sun comes in. And then I can go further, maybe open up the window, get some fresh air too. But that requires stepping outside of the comfort zone of me being me. It requires stepping out of that circular thought pattern that we often get caught up in. It requires effort. So another way to do that is to just stay in touch with your state of being and ask, what's my state of being right now? And if it's kind of bogged down, I'm unhappy, there's this, okay, leave it alone and then see if you can trace your steps back to the last time that you felt at ease. When did I feel at ease? Earlier, an hour ago, yesterday, 3 weeks ago, whatever. Yeah, I remember that. I felt at ease. What happened since then? I felt something. Something happened. Somebody said something. There's a memory. Something happened, right? Something always happens. And then my attention started to shift in that direction. I started to veer off. We started to veer, as he's saying here, very minutely, very minute shift of attention. But then you're already on a different course. It starts very tiny, but then we already are embarking on all different directions, right? But if we can trace our steps back to that, realize, okay, this happened, that happened. Okay, I get it. Something happened. It triggered me. And then I started to complain to myself, to my spouse, to my friends, to somebody became a punching bag, right? Okay, so I traced the attention back to that, and here's what happened. Now, this is what caused that slight shift of attention. Is there something I can do about it now? If the answer is yes, do. If the answer is, for the time being, nothing, then shelf it. And make a note which shelf you put it on. I'll get back to that. When there's something I could do about it or can do about it, I will. But for the time being, I'm aware of it. I'm aware of the sadness or memory or something. Okay, you come back to that again and again and again. And we can train ourselves. We actually can train ourselves to be this way. But like what we often say, it takes effort, continuous effort. So to clear the dust to see the Buddha, if we say form is no other than emptiness, the person is no other than Buddha, then what is it that gets in the way? Right? The one who is timed is timeless. I'll just finish with a line from Shantideva who said, "You're not here to change the world. The world is here to change you." Very profound. It's not what you think it is, though. We should strive to make changes, positive changes, healing, helpful changes in the world. But this is not what this is talking about. You're not here to change. You're here to learn who you are by observing. And I think that often by observing who we're not, we can see who we are. Thank you.